Welcome back to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 186. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Happy Friday, and we're going to get right back into where we left off in the last podcast. I have a lot to share with you. Let's get right into it without wasting any time, because there is so much that I have to share with you, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to get to everything. But I want to start off today with a passage from the Bible, Matthew 24. And in this passage, Jesus is with his disciples, and he is prophesying to them, giving a prophecy to his disciples about the destruction of the second temple. If you go to Israel today, you will still see the remains of that temple there. You'll see the wall, the Wailing Wall, where people go and they say their prayers, and they write down their prayers on little pieces of paper and put it in the wall. That wall still stands there, but there used to be a temple there, a full temple that was destroyed by the Roman Emperor Titus Vespasian in 70 AD. And this is a prophecy in Matthew 24, where Jesus is telling his disciples that not another stone. They're in front of this temple. Let's start reading here. Verse 1, Jesus left the temple and was walking away with his disciples. His disciples came to him to call his attention to its buildings. So the disciples come to him to call his attention to the temple. And Jesus says, "Do you see these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." And there's stories about how these fires that were set in the temple when Vespasian, and this is all recorded by Josephus, who was there when the siege was happening, witnessed it with his own eyes, that the gold from within the temple, that it melted, and they had to remove, the Romans had to remove stone by stone to get down to the gold. So this prophecy that Jesus is talking about with the temple becomes even more true, that not a single stone is left on. So he's prophesying about the destruction of the temple. Then he goes on to prophesy about his second coming. We'll see here in the third verse, as Jesus was sitting on Mount Olives, his disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you." And that's the part that I really want to focus on. This, and I could go in, I mean, this passage, Matthew 24, this prophecy that Jesus is giving is so relevant to things that we're dealing with today. I could go on and do the whole show just talking about this passage, but I don't want to talk about this passage and dive into that, to the whole thing. I just want to focus on this verse 4, where Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you." In the King James, it says, "Take heed." So Jesus is putting the responsibility of not being deceived on us, on his disciples. He's telling them, watch out. It's up to you not to be deceived. "For many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and deceive many." But as the King James says, take heed. It's up to you to make sure that you're not deceived. Watch out. Jesus is saying, you watch out. You take heed. You take responsibility for the fact for you not being deceived. And if you're head of household, making sure that your wife's not being deceived, making sure your children or not being deceived, but the responsibility is on us. One of my favorite pastors, Jack Hibbs out of Chino Hills, Calvary Chapel, has written this book. I haven't got it yet. I will be getting it and reading it, but I saw an interview that he did, and he's talking about deception and how prevalent deception is in our society today. Deception has always been the tool that the enemy of humanity has used, but it's so much more prevalent today. Deception. And this book, Living in the Age of Deception, the interview I saw with Jack Hibbs, he discusses Matthew 24, but all kinds of, he just goes into all kinds of different passages from the Bible where we're warned over and over again not to be prey to deception. And right now, I tell you, we're only a month and a half into 2024, and the deception that we are engulfed with, it is diabolical, meaning that it originates from the pit of hell. This stuff is so diabolical. Now, on Super Bowl Sunday, the Senate ended up passing the, and I told you they were going to pass that. Once it came out of committee, there was no chance that they were not going to pass the $95 billion supplemental spending package, with the majority of that aid going to Ukraine. And they passed it with pretty much the entire Democrat caucus, and less than half of the Republican caucus. This is the way they get things done. If you look at, go back to the vote in Congress, that the Congress voted to approve George Bush's invasion of Iraq. Back then, it was the entire Republican caucus in the Senate vote, the entire Republican caucus, besides one Republican abstained or voted against it, and then less than half of the Democrat caucus. So now it's flipped. The war party has captured the Democratic Party, so the entire Democratic Party, except two people voted against it, and less than half of the Republican caucus voted for it. And I say that because I want you people to understand that this is not a partisan issue. Ah, my coffee's getting cold, so I want to drink my coffee. This is not a partisan issue, that these people, they have captured both parties. Now, there's a fight going on within the Republican Party. There's two factions within the Republican Party. But I used to be a Democrat, folks. I remember when I was a Democrat, we were against war. We would march in the streets. I marched against the Iraq war when I was a Democrat back then. Or I was an independent, but I was against the Iraq war. I remember marching against the Iraq war. We used to be, the Democratic Party used to be an anti-war party. Now they're full steam ahead. So now this is passed out of the Senate. The Senate has passed it. And now the game is to put pressure on the House of Representatives to bring this to the floor for a vote. And if Mike Johnson brings this $95 billion supplemental spending package to the floor, it's going to pass, and it's going to pass with the entire Democrat caucus. There may be a few in the Progressive caucus that don't vote for it because it's got aid to Israel in there. So you may get a dozen Democrats that don't vote for it because of the aid to Israel. In the Senate, Bernie Sanders and another Democrat voted against it because of the aid to Israel. So if Mike Johnson brings this to the floor, it's most likely going to pass with 85, 90% of the Democratic caucus, and then less than half of the Republican caucus. And they'll get it, and they'll get it through. So now the game is to put pressure on Mike Johnson to bring this to the floor, and they're using all kinds of deception. Who's this guy? Mike Turner. Mike Turner is a congressman from Ohio. He is the head of the chair of the Intelligence Committee. And Mike Turner is a big supporter of aid to Ukraine. Mike Turner went to Ukraine last year to visit with Zelensky. He told them that aid for Israel, the support for aid for Israel, for Ukraine in the United States was overwhelming, is what he told them. So this guy, Republican, is in full support of aid to Ukraine. And he's also the head of the Intelligence Committee. So this week, this guy, he puts out to the media this report about how there's some big security risk from Russia. He's the head of the Intelligence Committee. This is intelligence that we've had for over 2 years, not the public, but even Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, says we've known about this for 2 years. Mike Turner now has members of his own caucus in the Republican caucus, you know, calling for an investigation into this national security warning that he put out, saying that Russia has space nukes. And then the story was, oh, we better pass this $95 billion supplemental because Russia has space nukes. Never mind the fact that we have a joint international space station with Russia. We don't even have a shuttle program now. We can't even get our astronauts to the International Space Station. That when we send our astronauts to the International Space Station, the Russians give them a ride. And this guy, so they had some intelligence that Russia is going to use nukes to take out Elon Musk's Starlink and other satellites. This guy puts this out to spread fear that the Russians have some new technology, some new threat. And as soon as he puts that out, the media starts reporting on it. It's all engineered to get the public afraid. So the public puts pressure on their representatives to pass aid to Ukraine. So that happened this week. And another thing that happened that I want to talk about in this Senate bill to pass the $95 billion, $60 billion going to Ukraine. This guy, Lindsey Graham, voted against it. He was with the majority Republicans that voted against this bill. And this is such a scam. Anybody who would buy this, listen, people. If this $95 billion package, $60 billion to Ukraine, if it only needed one vote to pass, I guarantee, and Lindsey Graham was the vote that they needed to get this to pass, I guarantee you Lindsey Graham would have voted for this. I guarantee you he would. But since he knew that they had the votes to pass, that they had the Republicans and the Democrats, he voted against it so he can go back to his constituents and say, see, you know, I'm principled. You know, I'm not going to vote for this because it doesn't have the border stuff in it. I want you to take a listen to this clip.
There can be no backing off of helping Ukraine.
I am for Ukraine support. We can't pull the plug on Ukraine, let Putin get away with this.
We need to be all in with the goal of allowing Ukraine to evict the Russians.
There's bipartisan support for winning this war in Ukraine.
And it is in our national security interest to make sure they can beat Putin, so we need to keep helping them.
Big support, very important.
The best money we've ever spent.
Best money we've ever spent.
So I talked to President
So this
Trump
is him.
Today.
This is Lindsey Graham, and he's trying to blame it on Trump. I talked to President Trump today. So this guy's a snake, people. I don't understand, South Carolina, why you keep sending this guy to the Senate. He doesn't support you. So this is him on the floor the other day, just before they passed this $95 billion, and he's explaining why he's not voting for it. This is a con.
I talked to President Trump today,
And he's dead set against this package. I'm not going to vote for this aid package. I am voting no against aid that I believe is very much needed.
Mr. Graham.
So that's funny. This is one of my favorite clips from Lindsey Graham. Take a listen to what he says here.
As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person. As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person.
So they will fight to the last person. He doesn't care about the Ukrainians. How ghoulish can you be, Lindsey Graham, that if we keep throwing gas on this fire, keep dumping money into it, keep dumping weapons into it, keep escalating, that the Ukrainians will fight to the last person? How ghoulish is that? It's disgusting. But I want to show you one other thing real quick. Hold on. We're going to talk about this report that came out this week. And this was a report from Michael Schlesinger, I think, or Schlesinger is how you pronounce his name. He's a Democrat. He is a journalist that's on Substack. He was one of the journalists who was doing the Twitter files. And through his reporting, through a number of sources that he has, which he's kept private, I want you to listen to this clip about what he's reporting. And I'm going to talk about how this is relevant to Ukraine, because a lot of people don't put these things together. Russiagate, the spying on Trump, and what they did in the during his transition, before he was even elected, they were spying on his campaign. And take a listen to this clip.
Of curating the 2016 Russia collusion hoax by asking foreign intelligence agencies to illegally spy on the Trump campaign.
Lucas Tomlinson in Washington with more. Lucas.
Good early morning, Carly and Todd. This report from Substack, citing multiple unnamed sources, claims the U.S. intelligence community asked foreign spy agencies to help spy on more than two dozen associates of Donald Trump in the run-up to the 2016 election. It reads in part, quote, President Barack Obama's CIA director, John Brennan, had identified 26 Trump associates for the Five Eyes to target. A source confirmed that the IC had identified them as people to bump or make contact with or manipulate. They were targets of our own IC and law enforcement, targets for collection and misinformation. Now, the Five Eyes nations are the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Here's one of the reporters, Michael Schellenberger, who spoke to Jesse Waters last night.
If this binder contains what we have been told that it contains, which may include raw
He says that there's a binder too. Five Eyes. So Five Eyes are all these English speaking countries. And the way Five Eyes works is that each country spies on the other country's citizens, because the United States can't legally spy on us, because if they can't get a warrant on us or have justification to spy on us, it's legally against the law for them, for the United States to spy on the United States citizens. But the United Kingdom can spy on the United States citizens, and the United States citizens can tell the intelligence community of the United States what they learned through spying on United States citizens. In New Zealand can't spy on its own citizens, but the United States can spy on New Zealand's citizens and then tell New Zealand's intelligence community what they learned from spying. So that's the way Five Eyes works. So what Schellenberger is saying in this reporting, and he has multiple sources, is what he says, is that the Obama administration, and you remember all this stuff. I hope you don't forget that they spied on the campaign of Donald Trump in the 2016 election. Then after he won, they spied on his transition team. And then after he was sworn in, they spied on his presidency. They spied on his presidency in the early months of his first term. So what the reporting is, they told us, first of all, that that the dossier, that they got these FISA warrants and the fake Hillary Clinton dossier that she paid for was the impetus for starting the investigation. And then they told us that, no, George Papadopoulos, who was working for the Trump campaign, went to England, and then he met a Australian diplomat in England who told him that the Trump administration has dirt on Hillary. And the Australian diplomat told John Brennan and the CIA about what Papadopoulos said. And that's how the investigation is starting. Well, Schlesinger is saying, no, that's not how the investigation started. The investigation started because these Five Eyes agencies, that they were spying on members of the Trump campaign. They were bumping them, which means that they were making contact with them and getting them to incriminate themselves. And then they go and they turn that information over to the CIA or the FBI. And then the FBI opens up this investigation. What you need to understand is that all of this deals with Ukraine. Ukraine started in 2014, 2015, 2016. And they want to make sure that Trump doesn't come in and mess up what they got going on in Ukraine. So they had to leverage Trump, and they had to make Trump look like he is in cahoots with Russia. So that prevents Trump from you know, talking to Russia, making a deal with Russia, you know, resetting our relationship with Russia like the Obama administration said. Because if Trump would have done that in the early months of his administration, they would have said, see, he's a Russian asset. So they forced Trump to have this aggressive, this kind of adverse relationship with Russia, because they didn't want to mess up what was going on in Ukraine. Very important. Back to this debate in South Carolina that we talked about this debate in the last podcast, where, you know, Trump is hammering Bush about his brother, about 9/11, about the war in Iraq. This is earlier in that same debate. I want you to take a listen to this line of questioning and conversation.
Governor Bush, yep. You said defeating ISIS requires defeating Assad, but wouldn't that also put us into conflict with Russia, a country that supports Assad? So doesn't that mean effectively Assad's there to stay?
No, it doesn't. And that's the problem. The lack of leadership in this country by Barack Obama.
No, it doesn't. So just like his brother, regime change in Iraq, Jeb Bush was for regime change in Syria. And again, Syria is part of the Wesley Clark Seven. We talked about that. They want Assad gone. That was Obama, Democrat. That was his policy. And then Jeb Bush, if he would have come in, that would have been Jeb Bush's policy as well. If Hillary Clinton would have gotten elected in 2016, that would have been her policy. Donald Trump did not necessarily have that policy that Assad must go. Russia backed Assad. Iran backed Assad. And they said that they were going to back him and not let the United States topple that administration. So this starts off, I've talked about this before. This starts in 2015 with the fight of ISIS in Iraq. But you'll see where this is going, and we'll talk about ISIS as well.
Kerry, Hillary Clinton, thinking that this is a policy that works, this policy of containment with ISIS, it's a complete unmitigated disaster. And to allow Russia now to have influence in Syria makes it harder. But we need to destroy ISIS and dispose of Assad to create a stable Syria so that the 4 million refugees aren't a breeding ground for Islamic jihadists. This is the problem. Donald Trump brought up the fact that he would want to accommodate Russia. Russia is not taking out ISIS. They're attacking our team, the team that we've been training and the team that we've been...
The team that we've been training. Listen to what Jeb says here, that Russia is attacking our team, the team that we've been training. Who's he talking about? Listen again.
The fact that he would want to accommodate Russia. Russia is not taking out ISIS. They're attacking Our team, the team that we've been training and the team that we've been supporting.
Yeah, our team is ISIS, buddy.
It is absolutely ludicrous to suggest that Russia could be a positive partner in this. They are on the run. They are making, every time we step back, they're on the run. The question that you asked was a really good one about what you would do, what three things would you do? I would restore the military. The sequester needs to be reversed. I would have a strategy to destroy ISIS. And I would immediately...
Let's listen to Trump.
Mr. Trump, you were mentioned here. You did say you could get along very well with Vladimir Putin. You did at one point say, let Russia take care of ISIS.
Call me a genius. I like him so far, I have to tell you. Let me just tell you this. Jeb is so wrong. Jeb is absolutely so... That's just so you understand. You know what that is? That's Jeb's special interest and lobbyists talking. Look, let me just tell you something. Jeb is so wrong. You got to fight ISIS first. You fight ISIS first. Right now, you have Russia, you have Iran, you have them with Assad, and you have them with Syria. You have to knock out ISIS. They're chopping off heads. These are animals. You have to knock them out. You have to knock them off strong.
Which he did
do. Decide what to do after. You can't fight two wars at one time. If you listen to him and you listen to some of the folks that I've been listening to, that's why we've been in the Middle East for 15 years, and we haven't won anything. We've spent $5 trillion in the Middle East because of thinking like that. We've spent and Lindsey Graham, who backs him, who had zero on his polls. Let me just tell you something. We've spent. I only tell the truth, lobbyists. We've spent $5 trillion all over the middle. We have to rebuild our country. We have to rebuild our infrastructure. You listen to that,
right,
you're going to be there for another 15
years. All right, Governor
World
Bush,
War
III. Please respond.
So the very basic fact is that Vladimir Putin is not going to be an ally of the United States. The whole world knows this.
Vladimir Putin is not going to be an ally of the United States. The whole world knows this. This is in 2016, folks. Early 2016. I mean, so... And then watch this.
It's a simple, basic fact. They're not even attempting to take out ISIS. They're attacking the ally of the United States. The whole world knows this. It's a simple, basic fact.
You see who this is right here clapping and all happy? Ooh, get Russia. Russia's not going to be an ally of the United States. It's Lindsey Graham there.
They're not even attempting to take out ISIS. They're attacking the troops that we're supporting.
The troops that, there he says it again, that Russia is attacking the troops that we're supporting. Who are the troops that we are supporting? They are ISIS. The troops that we're supporting were ISIS people, and I'm going to show that to you here in a moment.
We need to create a coalition, Sunni-led coalition, on the ground with our special operators to destroy ISIS and bring about stability. And you can't do that with Assad in power.
We're supporting troops that we don't even know who they are.
Okay. We're supporting troops that we don't even know who they are. Jeb says that Russia's not our ally. Russia's not going to be our ally. That Russia's fighting the troops that we're supporting. Donald Trump says we're supporting troops that we don't even know who they are. Here, let me expand this for you. How ISIS got weapons from the U.S. and used them to take over Syria and Iraq. That's Newsweek. How ISIS got weapons from the U.S. and used them to take over Syria and Iraq. Yes, Putin was fighting the people that we were supporting, and the people that we were supporting were ISIS. ISIS came out of the Free Syrian Army. ISIS came out of the people that we were sending weapons to. When Donald Trump says that we're supporting people that we don't even know who they are, it was ISIS. Here's another one. Arming Syrian rebels, where U.S. went wrong. Here's another one. Here. What does it say? Now the truth emerges. How the U.S. fueled the rise of ISIS in Syria. Any more here? I think there's one more. It's CNN. Amnesty report. ISIS armed with U.S. weapons. When ISIS started to expand out of the Free Syrian Army, a reporter from The Atlantic did an interview with Barack Obama, and he says, this militant Sunni group is growing in Syria, calling themselves ISIS, and they look like they can be pretty dangerous, is what the reporter, I'm paraphrasing, said to Obama. And Obama said, you know, around here, we like to think of ISIS as a JV team. That just because you put a coat of, just because you put a Lakers uniform on them, that doesn't make them Kobe Bryant. A few months later, ISIS comes into Iraq, takes over Mosul with the arms that we gave them. We gave them. Donald Trump says we're supporting people that we don't even know who they are. Jeb Bush says that Russia is fighting the people that we're supporting. Yes, he's fighting the people that we're supporting. We're supporting terrorists. So it's funny because in the interview that Tucker Carlson did with Vladimir Putin the other day, Vladimir Putin brings this up and he brings up Obama. He's like, he tells, you know, Obama, he doesn't say Obama's name, but he says the president of this time. He says that he tells him that, hey, you know, your guys are supporting terrorists. And Obama says, well, how do you know that? And Putin says, well, I showed him the evidence. The same evidence that Putin took to the United Nations and showed that, hey, the United States is supporting terrorists. And he says that Obama said, I'm going to kick their butts or kick their ass, is what Putin says in the interview with Tucker, you know, talking about Obama, that Obama knew that they were supporting terrorists. They did not. And Putin knew that they were supporting terrorists. They did not want this guy to come into office and to collaborate with Putin and ruin their little game. So that's why they did the Russiagate. That's why they spied on him. That's why he had a 2-year special counsel investigation to determine if he was a Russian asset, which ended up telling us that he was not a Russian asset. That's why all of that happened. All right, so let's get into Ukraine. And if you guys remember back into Ukraine from where we were in the last podcast, because if you remember, I was telling you at the end of the last podcast that George Soros, the trade agreement with the EU had broken down, and Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, decided to do a trade deal with Russia. And when that happens, all of these people that open society or civil society, which is George Soros's organization that he has been supporting with his political philanthropy for 25 years in the capital city, all of that organization came to fruition when that trade deal broke down, that George Soros called over 100,000, nearly 200,000 people to Maidan, to Independence Square, and they protested. And it was a peaceful protest. And all of this is going on in Kiev. And I was telling you, people down here in Odessa, people in Crimea, people in Donetsk, they're watching what's going on in their capital city, and they don't necessarily agree with what's going on in their capital city. Some of these people may have even voted for Yanukovych, and they're watching this, and they're not only watching it, they're remembering that 10 years ago, the same thing happened. So they're remembering the Orange Revolution, and then they're watching this happen again. So what I'm telling you is not everybody in Ukraine agreed with what was going on in Kiev. So John McCain and Christopher Murphy, and like I said, it's always one Republican and one Democrat. There's bipartisanship. And they always show this bipartisanship when they go to Ukraine. One Republican, John McCain, and one Democrat, Chris Murphy. And we're going to go back to what they said about violence and sanctioning the Yanukovych government if there's violence. At this time, there is no violence. It's just a bunch of people in the square protesting. Chris Murphy and John McCain. They go down and they stand on the stage with these people. Some of these people, look at this, Yahoo. So this is December. The date on this is December 2013. So this is the end of 2013. The real protests start in 2014, January and February. The violence starts in February. But John McCain went, this is the headline here. John McCain went to Ukraine and stood on stage with a man accused of being an anti-Semitic Nazi. So McCain and Chris Murphy are not only there encouraging the people to continue their protests, saying that the United States has your back in this fight. I don't know why this Republican and Democrat senator were over there meddling in their business, but that's what they're doing. And then they also made statements that if there's any violence, that they will be sanctioning the Yanukovych government. This is the beginning of the coup. Take a listen.
Senators John McCain of Arizona and Chris Murphy of Connecticut also warned top country officials that there is broad support within the U.S. Senate to officially sanction individuals responsible for violence against protesters if authorities use such force.
I have introduced a resolution in the United States Senate that contemplates sanctions should there be violence on the square.
The senator's apparent.
Should there be, if there's violence, you know, at this time there was no violence. The violence, but violence is going to start, and violence is going to start when the Nazis get involved. And John McCain was accused of standing on the stage with Nazis. There were Nazis involved in the protest, and, you know, in the interview, going back to the interview that Putin did with Tucker last week, he says that that's one of his goals, is to go in and to root out the Nazis in Ukraine, that the Nazis were the problem. This is really interesting because this is a Washington Post article about the interview that Tucker Carlson did with Putin. And this part's really interesting right here. It says, Putin also told Carlson that the main reason for the invasion is one of Moscow's continuing chief goals to the denazification of Ukraine. Quote, denazification of Ukraine, part of Putin's continuing false allegation that Kiev is controlled by Nazis. It's a false allegation that Kiev is controlled by Nazis, according to Washington Post. Ukraine is a democracy, and Zelensky, who was overwhelmingly elected president in 2019, is of Jewish descent, as are other top officials. Putin's real goal, many analysts say, is to oust Zelensky in favor of a Russian puppet regime. So there's no Nazis in Ukraine, according to the Washington Post. And that's really weird because in 2015, there were Nazis there, and we knew there were Nazis there. Again, John Connors, and there was another representative that was with Connors. John Connors was the Democrat, and I think there was, I don't remember the Republican who he was collaborating with, but they were blocking any funds in 2015 from going to Ukraine because the Nazis were in charge in 2015. So what happened to the Nazis? How'd the Nazis all of a sudden disappear? This is the post from Ro Khanna, Democrat Ro Khanna, that he deleted. And two podcasts ago, I mentioned this post, this Twitter tweet that Democrat Ro Khanna tweeted out in 2018. Ever since the Orange Revolution began under President Bush, the U.S. has been complicit in the rehabilitation and spread of neo-Nazis in Ukraine. Enough is enough. Our government must stand up to the Azov Battalion and fascist groups. So did the Nazis disappear when he deleted this tweet? Because I'm trying to figure out what happened to the Nazis. If there were Nazis there in 2018 and Ro Khanna knew that there was Nazis there and the Congress, you know, was not giving money to the Nazis, what I want to know is what happened to the Nazis. The Nazis must have disappeared when Ro Khanna deleted this tweet. But like I was telling you, that in Trump's transition, and Trump was president-elect. This is, again, January 2014, a week before Trump is sworn in, that the Congress has removed a ban on funding neo-Nazis from its year-end spending, that they changed this policy about giving money to Nazis just before Trump comes in. And I'm telling you, they do this because they're setting Trump up. Take a look at this clip. This is the date. You see it right there, December 2016. Again, this is December. Trump is president-elect. He's president-elect. He's coming in just a few weeks. He's already won the election. He's coming in just a few weeks, and he's commander-in-chief, and it's his job to do foreign policy. If his foreign policy was to mend the relationship with Russia and have a at least a workable relationship with Russia, that is Trump's objective. That is his foreign policy. But John McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Amy Klobuchar are over in Ukraine while Trump is president-elect in December 2016, and they are conducting his foreign policy. They already had the insurance policy in place because they're spying on him. They're not going to let him have a workable relationship with Russia. They want an adverse relationship with Russia, and they're setting Trump up to where they're forcing him to have this adverse relationship with Russia because there are, you know, spreading this false information that Russia, that Trump is a Russian asset. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Amy Klobuchar. This is Poroshenko. Petro Poroshenko is the president at this time. And these guys are over there conducting Trump's foreign policy before he's sworn in. It's outrageous.
Your fight is our fight.
Your fight is our fight, Lindsey Graham. Your fight is our fight. He starts off strong. Your fight is our fight.
Your fight is our fight.
Ваша боротьба – це наша боротьба.
2017 will be the year of offense.
2017 will be the year of offense. What if that's not Trump's foreign policy? What if Trump doesn't want 2017 to be the year of offense? Why are you over there, Lindsey Graham and John McCain? This is John McCain. This is a separate trip that John McCain is taking from the one that he took in 2014, in the beginning of this mess with Chris Murphy. He's over there again with Lindsey Graham this time. Your fight is our fight. 2017 will be the year of offense. Trump hasn't even been sworn in yet.
All of us will go back to Washington, and we will push the case against Russia.
Ми всі повернемося до Вашингтону, і ми будемо відстоювати санкції проти Росії.
Enough of a Russian aggression.
Enough of your aggression, Lindsey Graham.
It is time for them to pay a heavier price.
I believe you will win. I am convinced you will win, and we will do everything we can to provide you with what you need to win.
This is Amy Klobuchar right here, Senator Amy Klobuchar. And again, Senator Amy Klobuchar, I told you, it's always Democrats and Republicans. Always, always, if you pay attention to this, always Democrats and Republicans. So Amy Klobuchar is representing the Democrats. Lindsey Graham and John McCain are representing the Republicans. So they knew that there were Nazis there. They knew that there were Nazis there. And when this all happened in 2014, when George Soros, civil society gets over 100,000 people to Maidan that are there protesting peacefully, the Nazis come in, and then that's when the violence starts. I want you to take a listen to this BBC report. BBC and European media, I mean, they did great reporting on this. Our media, not so much. That's why most people don't know any of this stuff that I'm telling you, because our media did not do a good job in reporting any of this. They wanted people ignorant of any of these facts that I'm sharing with you, because if you're ignorant, then you will go along with the war machine, the military industrial complex. And that's all this is. This is straight up evil, people. Take a listen to this report from BBC. I want you to notice before we listen to this and watch this, I want you to notice what the title of this BBC report is. It says, "Neo-Nazi Threat in New Ukraine." So remember George Soros talking about the new Ukraine versus the old Ukraine. That the old Ukraine was pre-Euromaidan and the new Ukraine is after the Euromaidan protests. And the BBC titles this report, "The Threat in the New Ukraine." So the Nazis are part of the new Ukraine too. Don't think the Nazis disappeared when Ro Khanna deleted his tweet. take a listen to this clip.
In place of the defiant speeches, the somber strains of Beethoven now ring out over Independence Square. This revolution is moving into a new phase. But amidst the flowers and the children's tributes, flashes of something more sinister. Groups of armed men strut through the square with dubious iconography. That yellow armband is a Volksangel, a German symbol used by several SS divisions during the Second World War. Far-right graffiti is appearing, daubed on the walls of the city. The people who brought down the government were overwhelmingly ordinary Ukrainians, students and doctors, workers and even families, people who simply refused to back down. But the most organized and perhaps the most effective were a small number of far-right groups. When it came to confrontations with the police, it was often the nationalists who were the loudest and the most violent.
So that part of the clip is most important. So we'll go back and we'll listen to it again. And I'm going to point out what this guy says. And it's very important, because it's like I was telling you about the Black Lives Matter. We remember the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. And like I was telling you in the last podcast, they were mostly peaceful. They were peaceful people marching during the day. And then at night, when the sun went down, they set fires, they burned down buildings, they were looting, it was violence. And then the sun would come up and then it's peaceful again. It's peaceful. That the peaceful protest gave cover for the violence that they were using, that they worked together. That the peaceful protest gave cover for the violence protest. So that's what happened in Ukraine in 2014. George Soros calls all of his peaceful, like he says here in this clip, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're teachers, they're students, you know, just people, open society, civil society protesters, and they gave cover for the Nazis. He says that when the Nazis came in, they were the most organized and the most effective. Let me tell you something, people. Yanukovych never would have been overthrown if there was only peaceful protests, if only the open society people were there in the square protesting, demanding that he step down or demanding that he holds new elections. Again, because he was representing the people in all of Ukraine. He wasn't only representing the people in Kiev and the civil society protesters. Yanukovych had people in Odessa that he was responsible for. He had people in Crimea he was responsible for. He had people in Donetsk that he was responsible for. Just because George Soros is able to call 150, 200,000 people to a square in Kiev doesn't mean that Yanukovych ignores the will of the rest of Ukraine. So there's no way that Yanukovych would have fled power unless there was violence. and the violence came from the Nazis. Listen to this clip again.
It were overwhelmingly ordinary Ukrainians, students and doctors, workers and even families, people who simply refused to back down. But the most organized and perhaps the most effective were a small number of far-right groups. When it came to confrontations with the police, it was often the nationalists who were the loudest and the most violent.
The Nazis were the most effective. The Nazis and their violence is what essentially got Yanukovych to leave and started the coup d'etat. Let's listen to George Soros now. And again, he tells the story about how the violence starts. Take a listen to George Soros here.
Well, it's really basically the rise of civil society that spontaneously rebelled against a continuation when the association agreement was offered, and then Putin outbid the European Union, which wasn't very difficult, and offered $15 billion. And Yanukovych then made a deal with Putin. And the people then rebelled. They went to Maidan.
Only the people in Kiev rebelled. Not all the people rebelled. That's what I'm trying to get you to understand, is that not all the people rebelled. Only the people in the capital city. The people in Odessa didn't rebel. The people in Crimea didn't rebel. The people in Donetsk, they didn't rebel when Yanukovych made the trade deal with Russia. The only people who rebelled was the civil society, open society groups that George Soros had been organizing for 25 years. They're the ones who rebelled.
Putin. And the people then rebelled. They went to Maidan and they protested. Putin said to Yanukovych, before you get your first $3 billion, you've got to get rid of those people.
There's no evidence of that, what George Soros is saying, that Putin told Yanukovych, before we give you any money, that you have to clear the people out of Maidan. There's no evidence of that. George Soros is lying. So, I don't know where he's coming from.
Putin said to Yanukovych, before you get your first $3 billion, you've got to get rid of those people in Maidan. Basically ordered Yanukovych to use force.
So Putin, this is what George Soros is saying, is that Putin ordered Yanukovych to use force to get rid of the protesters. Back to John McCain and Chris Murphy, that if the Yanukovych government uses force, then we're prepared to sanction them. George Soros is telling this story after the fact, lying, saying that Putin told Yanukovych that you're not going to get any money, your first $3 billion, unless you use force to clear. This is a lie. What George Soros is saying here is a lie.
Basically ordered Yanukovych to use force. And this was a fatal mistake on the part of Putin that he's now trying to remedy as best he can, because he simply is not within his view of the world to believe that people will actually act spontaneously and even risk their lives for a political cause. When they wanted to clear the square, people, instead of running away ran to Maidan, and that was the first time Yanukovych actually was forced out of power. And then when he was already out of power...
And this part right here is so hilarious, this story that George Soros is saying, because he's saying that the people went to Maidan, the people who he called to Maidan, he says that they went spontaneously, but the people who he called to Maidan, over 100,000, 150,000 people, went to Maidan, and then Putin told Yanukovych to clear the square, and that then he started to clear the square, and then more people came to Maidan. He's not talking about the Nazis, not talking about the violence or any of that, and he says that's what drove Yanukovych out of power, that Yanukovych is out of power now and that he had fled to Russia. And then he says that, take a listen to what Yanukovych does from Russia. This is hilarious.
Ran to Maidan, and that was the first time Yanukovych actually was forced out of power. And then when he was already out of power, and already Putin was in Sochi and had Yanukovych brought to him and ordered him to use live ammunition, which was in February of 2014.
Okay, so... Yanukovych is already out of power. That, according to George Soros, Yanukovych had to flee because of all the people in the square that were pushing back because Putin told Yanukovych to clear the square. So Yanukovych was unsuccessful in clearing the square. He had to flee Ukraine and go to Sochi, where Putin was. And then after he's already out of power, Putin orders him to use live ammunition. He's already gone. What are you talking about? If he's already gone, how is Putin ordering him to use live ammunition against the protesters, George Soros? That makes no sense at all.
To use live ammunition. And already Putin was in Sochi and had Yanukovych brought to him and ordered him... to use live ammunition, which was in February of 2014. Again, the people, instead of running away, actually attacked the snipers and chased them away.
All right, so we're going to talk about... the use of live ammunition and the snipers, and who actually started to do the shooting there in Maidan. Who were the snipers? Who started the violence? Who started the shooting? Because that's what kicked off the real violence there in Maidan, is once the snipers, whoever the snipers were that started shooting. And we're going to talk about some theories about, we don't really know who the snipers were. And nobody knows for a fact of who the snipers were, but I got some theories that I'm going to share with you about who the snipers were. And we'll talk about that in the next podcast. There's still so much that I need to share with you guys, but I hope you're starting to see how all of this stuff took place, how we got involved with this mess, and we're just dumping money into this hole now. You guys have a great weekend, and I'll see you.